Hey, it's time for Dr. Lisa Gives a Shit. And I'm Dr. Lisa. How are you doing today? How's your pandemic experience going? You know what I'm thinking about a lot lately? I've been thinking about what's relevant and what isn't. It's a big one, right? Like nothing seems what was important before. Is that going to be important again? Should I throw out my entire wardrobe? Are people going to be completely dressed differently? Is makeup on the way out? And then like things I really care about. But that's actually, I'm really lucky because we actually have a therapist on today. So maybe we can talk a little bit about that. But mostly I want to say thank you for listening to Radio Free Brooklyn, and thank you for listening to Dr. Lisa Gives a Shit. We really appreciate it. We had a really good internal meeting. The station is, we're trying to keep our attitude up, our morale up, and we are. But you know, like this is a really tough time for us. And if you're listening to Dr. Lisa Gives a Shit, first of all, thank you so much for listening, but also please go to Brooklyn, radiofreebrooklyn.com and donate. You know, keep us going, okay? Because we need to be here for you. So I'm very excited about my guest today. Like I said, she's a professional, licensed, highly experienced therapist and writer. Her name is Sherry Armist. I'm not going to get her last name right.
I'm Matt. That's okay.
That's okay. And she's here in my virtual studio. So the reason that I got in touch with Sherry and asked her to be on my show, which I'm grateful to have her, have you, thank you, Sherry, is because Sherry is doing real therapy sessions on the radio as a real therapist. And you know, this is sort of like, you know, my world. And I was listening to some of her sessions, and they're very, very interesting. So she's great at it, and she's really accomplished, okay? She's written like four books. She is considered by many a relationship expert. She's been on TV and so many things. Hello, Sherry.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And you've also written a book, How Does It Make You Feel, which is a book about an anthology. Why don't you tell us who you are? Tell us about your books.
I've written three self-help relationship books, Dating Q&A, the Love Lessons from Bad Breakups, A Complete Marriage Counselor. And then the most recent one was an anthology, How Does That Make You Feel? True Confessions from Both Sides of the Therapy Couch. And those were essays from, well, myself and lots of therapists and about some aspect of our experience of who we are and as a therapist. And then people, all accomplished writers, writing about some aspect of their therapy. None of the patients and therapists who participated in the book were like working together. Everybody was writing about their own experience. But you know, the idea of it was because a lot of people think that A, if you're a therapist, you sort of like know everything. It's like I don't feel that people should view therapists as just these up on a pedestal creatures.
Like authority figures.
We're human beings as well. And so right doing the book, I thought about it a lot because it was also about a big thing about therapy is boundaries.
Therapy, excuse me.
A big piece of
Boundaries.
therapy is having boundaries. You know, we talk about that. Is the therapist in this day of instantly looking somebody up in Google, it's really hard to just be this figure who you know nothing about anymore because it's pretty easy to find out some things about your therapist, but certainly the therapy session it should not be about the therapist. It is about the patient. But it was sort of like in breaking boundaries in that sense, because all the therapists were talking about admitting their humanity in a lot of ways as they, you know, with their participation. Because it's dangerous. I think it can be dangerous when people do, a lot of people do give power to their therapists, and they can be taken advantage of. Doesn't happen often, but it can. So that's why I did the anthology.
Because you think that it's important that people see their therapists as just regular people and not...
Well, I mean, like, certainly I don't talk about my personal stuff with my patients. Not in that sense. But, and part of therapy is that it hopefully becomes a safe place, and there's the whole transference, counter-transference aspect of it, where you become the good mother figure, let's say. You know, the idea of therapy is to work through a lot of your stuff and kind of learn how to handle your issues better and understand yourself more and care about yourself. In a lot of ways, I'm a conduit, I guess.
Right. But what about the blank slate? I mean, that comes from...
Well, that's exactly it. I mean, therapists often viewed as that blank slate, and my book was kind of showing we are people with our own stuff. So how much can you be a blank slate? And I bring in... Well, now all my sessions are virtual, obviously, COVID. But I bring in my personal stuff if it's something that I feel can help the patient deal with his or her.
So if you have a story that's relevant, you will share it, or a thought. Or
I have a story that can be helpful for them.
Which is strict, and I mean, I don't believe in any one type of therapy. I think most therapists use a mix of different thoughts, right? Thought processes. But I think that... that isn't kosher or classic Freudian, right?
Oh, no, I'm not a Freudian.
No, but I mean, that's kind of like...
So, you know, Freud, look, he had personal relationships with some of his patients.
Yeah, I know.
Look at it that way.
I'm going to say this, having just spent literally maybe 5 or 10 minutes with you virtually, is I think you have a big personality. I mean, would other people say that about you?
You know, there's always the public persona and the private persona.
Right. But I think that my guess about you, my impression of you, is that you have a very large personality, that you are an outspoken person. Like you have a lot of thoughts and you have a lot to say. And if I met you at a cocktail party, it would be delightful, but I think you would be a presence in the room. Am I right?
That would be nice. Sometimes I am, sometimes I'm not. I mean, actually in a party situation, if it's people I don't really know, it can take me a while to, like, you know,
But you have a lot of personality. Yeah. I'm your partner, or somebody that knows you well would probably say that. But I'm also saying that, like, I imagine you as a therapist wouldn't be doing justice by trying to hide your personality. Do you feel that therapy sort of the training or the trope of it kind of does it make you feel repressed?
No. I mean, actually, I think that the relationships that I have with my patients are, you know, I've had some of the most profound experiences that I've had in therapy sessions. Well, for me, it's about helping someone see something. Mm-hmm. You know, or stop repeating a negative pattern or something like that. what was interesting for me in becoming a therapist, because my first career was in publishing, and I would write, I worked at women's self-help magazines, you know, so they're all about advice, you know, and I did relate romantic relationship columns and things like that. But therapy is different because it's not about giving advice from on high and telling you what to do. It's about helping someone come to see their stuff.
Right.
So if I see someone doing something that's really self-destructive or whatever, you know, I'm definitely going to bring it up and we'll talk about it and look at it because, you know, you don't want to see somebody jumping off a roof.
Yeah, right. So you started out in publishing. I think you're a prolific writer. I mean, you have like 4 books besides doing all the therapy and stuff. You're not just a writer, but you have a lot published. So when you started out in publishing, how did you decide that you wanted to be a therapist? Were you going to be a writer first?
Oh, you know, I always, when I was age 9, I sort of like sat down and started writing a novel, Marcy and the New Girl. So I always wanted to be a writer, but I was kind of torn because I come from a Holocaust background. My parents, all my relatives were Holocaust survivors.
Wow, your parents? I
never had a grandparent. You know, my parents met here after the war. And, you know, it's such a interesting background. I mean, because they're obviously, all my relatives were shaped by what they went through.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was, you know, you kind of feel like, well, I can't really cause trouble because look at everything they've gone through. And I was raised hearing all my mother's stories. And so I also wanted to give back. So one of my career goals, it really was like I thought about becoming a therapist early on, but I majored in communications and I went into publishing. And then I think what made me finally decide, you know, I'm going to go for it, was, well, my parents getting older, getting sick, 9/11. I did volunteer work there. I volunteered at a suicide hotline for a while. And then I wanted to feel that I was doing something that was really of service and had meaning. So I went to social work school, and I've been a therapist. I'm an LCSW licensed clinical social worker for like I guess around 13 years now.
Yeah, and you have a successful practice and a whole bunch of books and all that stuff. So you definitely, you know, you have accomplished quite a bit. So you're also first generation American.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. You know, I want to hear about your childhood, but I also, before we get into that, I was going to just ask you, because you have done a lot of books, or you've done more than one book, and you have relationships seem to be an area of interest to you. Is that something that you have a good, like, is it something that you're sensitive to in other people?
Well, I mean, I think that started, the books started as a result of, you know, I worked at, you know, again, women's magazines and then women's websites, like at iVillage and at Hearst. And, you know, I was writing dating columns as part of my job. Mm-hmm. And I would be on talk shows giving relationship advice. It felt like a little bit, you know, surreal. Well, I mean, because
why me?
Well, it was because the talk shows themselves are like, you know, were so idiotic.
Oh, I see. Because they asked.
And I think one thing that like was really funny and typified the whole thing. Well, this was also, I was doing a lot of those shows before I was a therapist, they would invite me on because I'd written some article, editor at a woman's magazine, you know, and then I'd be on like Geraldo or something. And then the Chiron would say, like, Carrie Mattson, relationship expert. And an ex-boyfriend of mine, his mother was watching, and then she started laughing, relationship expert, that's David's ex-girlfriend. You know.
Oh, that's so
funny. So yeah, so it was just
really, really funny.
Yeah. Yeah. But that's why that kind of led to my writing self-help relationship books. But, you know, in my private practice, and I also see patients, again, everything is virtual these days, at a clinic, and a lot of the patients at the clinic, I mean, are also under seeing a psychiatrist. Some of them are, you know, schizophrenic, right, bipolar,
prescribed drugs,
homeless, like really, you know, on the fringes. So, I mean, being a therapist is being a therapist. People who, I mean, certainly the, and you know, one thing I often say is the most important relationship that you'll ever have is the one with yourself. And when you feel good about yourself, you're going to have healthier relationships, you know.
What's your childhood like? I want to hear about that.
Well, because if you just desperately feel like, if there's a hole deep in you and you feel that the only thing that's going to fill it is having somebody who loves you, and feeling like you were never really loved by your parents, and, you know, all of those kinds of things, our relationship is not going to fill that hole or give your life meaning or make you feel, you know, fabulous about yourself. I often say to people, that's an inside job.
Right.
The healthiest relationships are between two people who are healthy in their own right, and you can form like an interdependency, but not a codependency. And, you know, because we are all so formed by so much childhood pain and just all of these things, there can be a lot of dysfunctional motivations in seeking a relationship and in the types of people who you pick as your partners. So it really is until you have good self-esteem and that good relationship with yourself, that you'll be with somebody who will treat you well and who is not your life, but a part of your life.
So do you think that what's more important, like, to a successful relationship, the people in the relation, is it about the match, or is it like, I would like to think ideally that really together, that two together healthy people can make a relationship work, whether they're like fit like hand in glove or not. What do you think? Do you think it's?
I mean, I think that there, you have to have the same goals. You know, hopefully you're both wanting the same thing.
Right. Living in the same town or something.
At least that. Just the same values, the same goals.
Yeah, values are important.
Be, you know, some kind of attraction, spark. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in the healthiest pairings, it is when you treat each other well, when you understand what a healthy relationship is, because it is difficult to go from me to we, and what does that mean?
Right. So what is your, I want to understand your example of relationships. So how did you grow up? You were obviously, you know, your parents, I mean, it sounds like it was, you know, a lot, but
it was. It was.
Where did you grow up?
Actually, I've always basically lived, I guess, in the New York area. So born in the Bronx, and then we moved to like Little Neck, which is kind of borderline. It's, you know, still Queens near Great Neck, right. All that stuff.
Right. So, like us birds. So you had,
and my parents were very overprotective, understandably, with everything that they'd gone through. So, you know, I was desperate to go away to college, but my older sister did not fight that good fight. So I had no chance.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. So you have a brothers and sisters. You have a sister then.
I have a sister.
An older sister. So, and you, what was the impact? Like what are the qualities that you experienced in having like parents who had gone through the Holocaust? Did they tell you stories?
I was raised hearing my mother's story
all the time. Yeah. Was it in the house? Was it part of the atmosphere? What was that like?
Yeah, I mean, it was always there. It was pretty much always there. I mean, and I went with my father when I was around 20 when he gave testimony in Germany at a war trial.
Oh my God, really? So, wow, yeah. You saw that?
Yeah.
Wow. And did he describe what his experiences were?
Well, this the defendant he had served time earlier for offenses that he had done in Russia. Mm-hmm. And the reason why this trial was happening was my father was from Lodz, which was a big town in Poland. And in 1944, he, his parents, and his three sisters were caught up in what was called a Spira, a roundup, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's when they were shepherded onto the cattle car and, you know, taken to Auschwitz. And the defendant, his nickname was the Boxer for how he treated people. And he was the defendant. And this particular charge was about his violence and the way that he was during the roundup.
So you had to sit through as a 20-year-old and listen to all that, right?
No, well, I wanted to go with my father.
Was it stuff that you had heard before?
Well, I just wanted to be, well, it wasn't about my father's in that sense. I just wanted to be a support for my father.
Right.
And, you know, and frankly, he could have given testimony in New York. His two sisters, he survived with two sisters. I mean, he watched his parents and little sister at Auschwitz be taken to the gas chambers.
Oh,
and
God, it's unimaginable.
I know. And then he was transferred to Dachau, and he was there for 8 months until liberation. So, I mean, you can't come out of that, you know, totally functional. It's horrific.
When you were a child, when you were growing up, did they talk to you? Like, was it something that you were like exposed to as a child? Something you had to integrate into integrated?
Yes. Yes. It was like mother's
milk. Understand that as a child. Did you have any other, like, how did you understand that? Like, did you have other friends, or did you and your sister talk about it, or how did
also it was my relatives. I mean, they all had gone through that. Mm-hmm. All my relatives had gone through that.
Were you around groups of people where it was discussed a lot?
Oh, yeah, around my relatives all the time.
Mm.
And, you know, I mean, I went to school with, you know, kids who didn't have that background. You know, I mean, I grew up like you grow up.
Right.
But it was definitely a part of me. It's always been a part of me.
But I remember like when I was like probably 8 or 9 learning, I'm Jewish, obviously, Levy, learning what the Holocaust was, right? And, you know, we had films at camp and stuff like that. And I found it incredibly terrifying and, you know, like all that, like, I mean, it resonated a lot of fear in me, but not in a constant way. Like, what was it like for you? Did you feel like you had more fear in your house or more Was there some kind of, was it anxiety? Like what did, you know, were people worried about what was going to happen, or was it just that they had suffered, or how did you understand it? Do you remember?
In a lot of ways too. I mean, I know my sister and my cousins and I feel grateful for that time for our parents, because they loved us so much. They came here with no money, no language, just having gone through everything they went through, and they all built lives. They started businesses, they raised families. Their focus was on their families. I mean, and they would, you know, they would socialize and do stuff like people do, but of course it colors you.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it colors you, it's there. And I felt very protective of them, of my family.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear protective.
I'd feel very protective of them. You don't want anything other than that to happen. But yeah, there is a level of, like, let's say PTSD, you know, there, of course. I mean, if my father was late getting home from work, this was well before cell phones, you know, my mother would get nervous, I'd get nervous. It's like, you know, you think something bad is happening.
Right. You know, so that kind of thing. An extra level of caution in your household, right? That would be normal, right?
Well, my parents were very...
Sorry?
Oh, my parents were very overprotective, for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
Which didn't sit well with me, but I understood why.
Right. And then with your sister as well?
Of course.
Yeah. So how did that manifest? Were you not allowed to do things that you wanted to do? Or
we had friends. We went out, you know. Mm-hmm. But there was always that, you know, there also was that your world should kind of be the focus of... You know, that you should live a life where I should just, you know, get married, raise a family, not, you know, and I sort of always had different, you know, kinds of, I didn't just want to be like, I kind of wanted to do stuff.
Right. Yeah, you seem like I said to you earlier, you seem really motivated. I think you seem like a really driven, hardworking person. Were you
all? Yeah. I guess I think I always wanted to, you know, help people. I definitely was driven to build a career and be able to take care of myself. That was always something, you know, I had an early marriage and divorce, and I always needed to know that I could take care of myself.
Mm-hmm. How old were you when you got married?
Oh, I got married like at 20 and divorced at 23. Really young.
Wow. And how did that come about? Did you meet somebody like in high school or did you?
College. Well, I sort of did everything early, I guess. I skipped a couple grades. So I got married a couple months after I graduated from college.
Oh, because you skipped you went to college early?
I graduated like barely 20, I guess. So yeah.
So you went to college at like 16? How did you
Because I also, I guess, because I skipped like, I, yeah, it was sort of like I skipped mm-hmm. second grade or something weird like that. And then I did like the 2-year SP, like skipping seventh grade. And, you know, in retrospect, it really wasn't good. It would have been better to not be in such a rush.
Had the development. Yeah. So
you know, because I was, you know, all my friends were a lot older than me. So I did all these things, you know, that I probably would have been fine doing later.
So did it seem normal when you got married? Did that seem like a normal age? Do you think that you were looking for some sort of stability or some kind of, you know, something solid from?
Well, I mean, I think at that age, you know, I didn't make a wise choice.
Well, I mean,
and it was very young, and I was very young. So,
what did your parents say about that?
They threw a big wedding.
What a big wedding! And were they excited that you were getting married?
They weren't pushing me to get married that young. But you know, to my parents, they definitely wanted to see their daughters married and taken care of.
You
know? But on the other hand, you know, I think they were, because both of my parents have passed now, but they were proud of a lot of the things that I subsequently did do. Like for instance, I was a part of Steven Spielberg's Survivors of the Shoah. I interviewed him. I did cover stories on him for USA Weekend. We did it like when Shoah was starting, because I was an interviewer for it. And then 25 years later on the 25th anniversary, which was really cool. Yeah.
So you've been part of, that's a community, isn't it?
And my parents were interviewed for it. I mean, Survivors of the Shoah is a video it's videos of survivors telling their stories. And I was an interviewer for it. Like in a 2-year period, I probably interviewed like around 60 survivors in their homes. I mean, there was a videographer and I was, you know, talking to them. With the pre-interviews I did with them, as soon as they found out I was a child of survivors, I was in like Flynn,
you know.
And my parents gave their testimony. They also were part of it.
So you must have a really kind of a real intimate knowledge for somebody who didn't go through that with that experience.
Well, I grew up with it.
Yeah. So how about like when you got divorced at 23, was that really hard or?
Yes, it was traumatic. It was very difficult.
That affect you? Do you think that has anything to do with your interest in couples or how did that affect you, do you think?
It was traumatic. It was very difficult. I think I did everything too young and I didn't really know myself, and I was always somebody, I guess, who was attracted to like being needed because I was so used to, you know, that's just sort of what I was like in a lot of ways. And he really wasn't the best person, you know? And so I was lucky to get out of it, you know, fairly young, and then I had a lot of really cool experiences. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, my first career was in publishing, and through being in publishing, I mean, I did some really, really cool things. I did sort of like George Plimpton, Walter Mitty types of articles where you sort of immerse yourself in some wacky experience. Oh, I performed on stage with the Rockettes.
You did? How did you wind up doing that?
Well, it's funny. I was at just like a dance performance with someone I was dating at the time. And I just turned to him and I just said, I want to be a Rockette.
And did you learn how to dance?
No. Well, I'm 5'1" and I'm not a dancer. And then, but I called the PR, the public relations person at Radio City. And I told her, you know, I'm 5'1", I'm not a dancer, but I want to perform with the Rockettes and write about it. So she, she said,
oh, and
yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So
stage with them.
I got an assignment from Newsday Sunday Magazine, which doesn't exist anymore. And I was working full time. So when they were going to be rehearsing I was in the Parade of the Wooden Soldiers, which is not a high kick number. I could not do that. but you know the marching number. You know,
oh, so you did that?
And marching. So when they were going to be, and they were going to let me do it, if the director felt that I passed, they were going to let me do it at the full dress rehearsal of opening of the opening night in front of like a full audience and all of that. So when the Rockettes would be rehearsing that number, they would call me. I would take a cab to Radio City and march with them.
Well, that's hilarious. That's hilarious. That must have been fun to get to.
It was. I mean, it was great. Yeah. I was a clown with the Moscow Circus. I did.
What about your dating life after you got married?
After I got divorced.
Did you ever get divorced? Right. That's what I meant. After you got divorced, not after you got married. Started.
Right.
Was it hard to get out? Like, did you ever get married again?
I've had like, and I'm in, you know, I have not gotten married again, but I've had serious like monogamous relationships, and I'm with somebody now. We've been together for a long time and we live together. So,
right.
You know, so, I mean, I did, you know, I sort of, as I said, I kind of did things a little ass backwards because I started after my divorce, then I lived with a roommate and started dating, you know.
Did you date a lot?
I always was more of a relationship. I was always more of a relationship person than like a dating person, mm-hmm. I guess, you know.
You'd have like long-term relationships.
Yeah.
Monogamous relationships. What's the longest relationship you've had? Is it 10 years or less, or
probably? Yeah.
Yeah. And what have you learned? Like, do you learn something every single time, or do you see your own self repeat?
Well, I mean, my partner now, we've been together for a while. We've known each other a long time. And, you know, this is it.
Right.
But definitely, hopefully, you know, we learn from every relationship that we're in.
Do you see patterns in your own relationships over the years? Did you see patterns?
Well, after my husband, I made way better choices.
Uh-huh.
In fact, I'm still friends with people who I had. One of my closest friends is the first person that I had a relationship with after my divorce.
Oh, that's so nice.
Yeah, we dated for like 2 years. Oh, and you know, we've been, you know, he's a very close friend, you know, so.
No, that's a lifetime relationship, whether you're married.
Absolutely, for sure.
Yeah. I personally think it's always a good sign if you're friends with your old boyfriends or partners or whatever. I think it's a sign of a healthy relationship. Do you think that maybe getting married was a way for you to transition from being like a child to an adult?
I think it helped me get out of the house.
Because uh-huh. You didn't go away. Did you want to go away to college?
Desperately.
And what was your fantasy of going to college?
I mean, I just wanted the experience of going away to school.
And you your know? Parents were no, just no.
No, they were very, you know, so my sister and then myself, we went to Queens College. And then, you know, I mean, I got married like pretty instantly. I graduated in May and I got married that October. So
do you think if your parents had let you go away to college, it would have been a different story? Like,
Most likely, probably.
What you were looking for is finding yourself, sort of?
You know, I'm sure it would have been different. I would have had different experiences. I would have met different people. But, you know, I mean, it was what it was. And I do believe that we do have, you know, even in relationships that I've had that were not good ones, and again the marriage was the only really not good one, you know, we learned, like I wrote a book, Love Lessons from Bad Breakups, and each chapter I interview separately each person involved in a relationship that didn't work out, mm-hmm. you know, for their different interpretations of what happened. But, you know, if we go, and I do, as you said, you know, I do couples work, and it's kind of always about, it's not about, if you're in a relationship, it kind of has to be about two people being there for each other. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you don't give yourself up, but you also are there for your partner and what they need. And, you know, especially when you're with somebody for a while and you go through stuff, you know, like I'm going through a medical thing now, and, you know, my partner is there for me 1,000,000%, you know, being there, going through it in the time of COVID makes everything harder.
Oh, you know? Of course. But you, I mean, you have a certain level, well, of maturity too, and experience, life experience. But
oh yeah. At this point,
you're talking about is trust. So a lot of it is really, it feels like a lot of it's about trust and experience together and growing together. But I also think that, I mean, what I'm thinking about, I want you to explain if you would, is codependency. Like, we're talking about boundaries. Is that sort of what you're talking about also? Like the boundaries that you have around yourself and the other, you know, to keep separate. But how do you know where you should draw the boundaries?
Well, I mean, codependency is, and you know, there's a lot of codependency is a very unhealthy dynamic. You know, often like one person has the quote unquote power and the other person is scrambling to do everything they can to make the other person happy.
Right.
You know, we do, it always sounds cliche to say it, but we do, our idea of what a relationship is molded by our parents' relationship.
Right.
And our relationship with our parents and all those kinds of feelings. And often until we really understand what we're doing, we often just unconsciously replicate those patterns, and they're not always very healthy ones. And two people often find each other and they each fit that same dysfunctional duo.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not, and it's really only once you understand yourself and your patterns and why you're doing what you're doing that you can develop, I think, a healthy dynamic together, which is about, that you both care about each other, but you're also able to sort of do stuff to build yourself up as well, you know. And certainly when I do work with couples, a lot of it is about, you know, I like it when people come early, not when they're so stuck in really dysfunctional patterns of, you know, not trusting each other, terrible communication, just like no respect, certainly people do stuff because of their issues, you know, and there are other, but there's still two people in a relationship. Whenever people come in and they say, it's all your fault,
you this, you that,
I always say there's two people in a relationship.
Yeah.
You both create this together.
Right, right. I think a lot of couples have trouble understanding that. Do you? Like, they think it's one, do you think this is common where the person, where each person thinks it's the other person with the problems?
I mean, that definitely can be the case. It depends on the people involved, but that often can be.
Common one? What you're saying about one person trying to please the other. So that's a hard dynamic to get out of also, I would think, because the person who's not asserting themselves has to understand that they deserve more, or they should assert.
Absolutely. Absolutely. For sure.
And do you think that the other person who has the power is trying to take advantage of them, or...
I can't say for all the time, but that, you know, that certainly can be the case for sure.
Yeah. And it has a lot to do with self-esteem. So stereotypically, women probably undervalue themselves.
Though, you know, I've seen a lot of men also who undervalue themselves too. You know, I used to do workshops for men, and it was really always very interesting to see, you know, like if you have a circle of women and a circle of men, the different ways that they view how the other sex treats them.
Oh, yeah.
And a lot of men, look, certainly in the dating world, you know, and being in New York for sure, you know, a lot of men would feel, well, I have to have enough money and a nice car and this and that, and whatever, you know. It's also, so it's there's a lot of levels involved.
Yeah, it depends. Well, there's also, like, I think ego gets so involved in dating for everyone, for both men and women, and women want, you know, they all want something that makes reflects well on them. I mean, that's a trap too.
And again, you know, not to generalize, but there are a lot of traps, let's say, that people do fall into. And, you know, a lot of the work, and when I do work with couples, I always say part of the couple's work is individual work, because you have to look at yourself and your stuff and how you are participating and contributing to all of this as well.
Right. So, you know, hey guys, just so you know, my husband and I, since we've been together, which is close to 20 years, we've been in and out of couples therapy regularly. I think it's a good, healthy part of a relationship. Personally, I'm just telling you, that's what I think. I think it's a good tool to have in your toolbox.
Absolutely. It's sort of like it has this bad reputation, let's say.
Like something
that, oh, well, if we love each other, it means that there's something terrible. And no, it's, and I love when couples come before they get married or, you know, early on, and they sort of learn more how to communicate and just all the factors involved in what does marriage mean to you? What does it mean to you? What are your values? What are your goals? And just there's a lot involved, you know, there's really...
New York City is not a normal place. That's not dating like
that's it. True. New York
right?
City is not your
normal place. So anybody who's from New York City that's dating, and that includes Bushwick folks, this is not normal. It's a whole other thing. People are way too type A here to have any kind. They're all ambitious. They may not be type A, but everybody wants something that comes here. So, you know, which isn't good for young people. Okay, you got to like establish, you know, just know who you are, right? That's what I'm saying, guys. So you were remarking that you've been doing a lot of therapy through the COVID time period. And I wanted to get some, we only have 10 minutes left, but I wanted to get some of your insights on what you've been seeing in your practice.
Well, it's, you know, I always say that you have the issues that you had before and then all the COVID stuff on top of it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, it's a lot to deal with. There's so much, Shay, my dog. My dog has a lot to say about this topic. And, you know, and there's so many stressors that are real. People have lost their jobs, you know, health issues that have gone untreated. People who are alone, people who are kind of in not great relationships and, or just big families and all, you know, there's so much involved in all of it.
I think is a whole other story.
Yeah. And the fear and, you know, there's a lot of, and the whole limbo of not knowing when this is going to be over.
Right.
And you have to have people agreeing, you know, if you're a unit, what one person does right now, the other person will be impacted by.
Right.
One person just goes out and about and they're exposing themselves to stuff. you're also exposing whoever you're living with.
Of course, of course. But it feels like there, to me, it just feels like there's sort of free, I call it free-floating anxiety everywhere.
There's so much anxiety and stress. And, you know, I definitely, you have to self-nurture.
Uh-huh. What does that mean?
And I think a lot of things that are healthy, and certainly, you know, if you need therapy, reaching out is a healthy thing to do in terms of that. Definitely trying to keep to some kind of routine, you know, and working out is a good thing.
Being physically fit, getting rid of your stress through your body.
Eating well, sleeping, you know, like all these things are really important. You know, getting outside is a helpful thing. It's hard. The isolation of it is really difficult because now we're sort of like our relationships are on Zoom.
You know? You know, it's funny because I noticed myself, I've been having this issue myself. So I feel comfortable, like, you know, social, having a drink, social distancing, right? But now I feel like it's such a big deal to ask people that I feel self-conscious about inviting people to hang out. Do you know what I mean? Which is holding me back. You know what I'm saying?
Well, I mean, as long as you're, I think that everybody has to make their own decisions.
Right.
And in some ways, I think what is perhaps the best way of doing it is like people have their, I've heard it referred to as like a pod. Like you have the people who you know and you trust. And if you hang out together, like outside is best, the 6 feet apart thing is good, you know, but probably not just going out.
I'm also talking about, and I've talked to other people about this. I think what I'm really talking about is that I have, you know, I'm used to like going out and like socializing, running into people, but it's been, I feel like I'm losing my nerve socially. I feel like I'm getting more, I don't know if the word is introverted or isolated or just not confident with people socializing. I'm losing confidence from lack of practice maybe or something.
Well, I think you said that you still want to get together physically with people, but that the people who you're sort of talking to are kind of
just sort of afraid to ask in a way. I mean, I feel like I don't want to put myself on the line.
What started that for you? The feeling that you're putting your, why do you feel that you're putting yourself on the line if you ask somebody if they want to socialize?
I don't know. I mean, I'm just noticing. Do you have a whole, I don't want to try and get a free hour out of you, but this is definitely so.
Well, we don't have that much time left.
With my therapist tomorrow, but I've noticed, I'm just saying, I was a very shy kid and I noticed that I'm regressing as far as being socially outgoing or proactive.
Without flexing those muscles.
And I am, yeah, reverting, and I think regressing, and I think that is really common that people are regressing, right?
Well, it's so, you know, we're also where we like to be with each other and touch and do all those things, and all of a sudden we can't.
Right.
So it is, you know, we're sort of thrown backwards and developing what else can a relationship be.
Right, yeah. Right. It's so unnatural. And
it is. It is unnatural in a lot of ways.
Yeah. It's really unnatural. I think one of the things that's important is for everybody to keep in mind that everybody is feeling this.
Yeah, I mean, there is, and I think that's good too, to know that there is that community, that commonality. You know, we are in this together, but also to know this will end. Yes, we don't know when, but this will not be forever. But, you know, and I think it's also good to notice, like, what can you learn about yourself?
Right. And I think I hear a lot of that going on, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and that's a good thing, because we certainly know the negatives. We can, you know, each say, rattle off 20 negatives in like, you know, a minute and a half, probably. But it's also like, this is also, it's very challenging and awful in a lot of ways, but it's also an opportunity.
Oh, you mean instead of just like learning what's horrible about yourself to actually learn something good?
Oh, well, yeah, and that's it too. It's sort of like, see, for like, sure.
I'm totally the wrong person to be in a pandemic. Like, I am like always worrying that I'm not productive enough. And being in the pandemic, there's no way to evaluate your productivity because you're just doing what you're doing at home and it's not out there and, you know, there's no use for it. And there's no like realization for things the way that one would hope. And I think that that is a real trip. You know what I mean?
Well, it's definitely a trip. And it's also, but I think when we chatted before we went on air, you know, and are saying I'm trying to also, one of the things that this is teaching me, hopefully, is that I don't always have to be doing. I don't always have to be.
Well, you don't have that problem because you're an overachiever.
Well, but I can just sit and read or listen to music or watch, you know, I've been like ODing on Frankie and Grace.
Do you like
and that? Have that be okay? I mean, do I miss all the stuff? Yes.
Well, we only have a minute left, so tell me.
Oh, I did just want to mention, because you mentioned earlier, my podcast is Sherapy, Real Therapy with Sherry Mattenstein. And it's basically I probably just do it like once a month at this point, but it is, I do an anonymous therapy set, you know, people come on and it is a therapy session. Uh-huh. We don't say their name and we change certain details, but yeah.
Are they ongoing patients of yours, or how do you
find them? No, I would not do that with a patient of mine.
Right. So how do you find them?
Well, I'll sort of like put it out there, like on social media or ask or things like that. And I do an hour long intake with them just as I do with a new patient so that I know them and what's going on for them and we can focus the session. So,
wow. That's
true. And I started that a lot just to like not have the stigma so much of therapy. I think I mentioned to you when we spoke on the phone, my idea for it came after a friend of mine killed himself last summer. And I think, you know, there is still that stigma of reaching out and going for help. And so, and especially now in these COVID times when everything is piling on, I think we need to like self-nurture and take care and not be, and be able to reach out. So
I'm going to say your version of online therapy, radio therapy, is a lot more noble because it's actually based on really wanting to help people and do something for mental health. And I am sort of a bit focused on entertainment. So,
but I'm also the one who's really a therapist.
Oh yes, there's that. I know. We all know that. But anyway, I just want to say thank you so much.
Thanks
I'll
for
post
having
everything
me.
On Facebook about your you know, your information. And I want to say thank you to everybody for listening to Dr. Lisa Gives a Shit. I'm here every Thursday, 2 to 3. Go to radiofreebrooklyn.com, look for my archives. And stick around this afternoon. We've got Lost and Rewound right after this, which is so entertaining and funny and great music. And then Sitting with Gianluca. It's one of our most popular shows. He's amazing. He's great. He knows so much about music. And he's got great taste. He plays great music.